Good afternoon, everyone. It's Dr. Nigro again with our next episode of Psychology Unplugged. Thanks, many thanks to all of our followers globally. Again, a humbling experience to be able to do this. And when my father suggested it, I never thought it would have the magnitude that it has and the impact that it has, and that I would have the privilege to talk to people internationally and have people fly in from all different parts of the world. And I had a wonderful family that I've connected with who flew in over the weekend, and amazing people, and hopefully we'll be able to stay in contact. But thank you for all of your support and comments and suggestions and positive feedback. So as we move into spring, the weather's getting a little nicer, at least in this part of the world. But today's topic is something, that I want to talk about because I think it's pretty relevant, and it's based off of someone, in Minnesota who emailed me about how do you find the right therapist? And I thought it's a great question. It's like, you know, everybody, like Jerry Seinfeld, I think, made an observation like, you got to see my doctor because he's the best. Not everybody can be the best in any field, and people have specialties, and, you know, finding the right clinician. And I am very privileged to work with clinicians from across multiple disciplines, whether that's psychotherapy, trauma specialists, prescribers, including my wife, but also other colleagues who specialize in children or work with a variety of different individuals. So there's a lot of different acronyms, and I don't know, please forgive me if I, you know, because we have such a wide audience, to be an effective therapist, or if you want to see somebody, I would strongly suggest that you see somebody who has professional licensure in a discipline of psychology, of social work, that is a licensed individual. Now, I'm speaking as somebody who was once a student, and as a student, you have to get clinical training hours in your practicums and in your internships and residencies and postdoctoral training. So if you're in larger organizations, you may very well be assigned somebody who is a master's level clinician, but they are under the supervision, or are supposed to be under the supervision, of a licensed psychologist, a licensed professional. So I think that is a key component in searching for, I think it depends on where you live and where you have what you have access to. And in the world that we live in right now with telehealth, it's a lot of different options for psychotherapy. But just stepping back to, you know, licensure, I mean, I did see patients when I was a student, and I learned and I practiced, but I'm very grateful because I got great supervision. Just Julie with the water again. So licensure is crucial, and same in Julie's discipline. If you have a prescriber, they're not licensed, I would certainly double check why you're seeing that person, because you do need licensure to be able to prescribe medication. You also need a different type of licensure when it gets to testing, and I will talk about that. But licensure is really important because you have to meet certain standards. You have to be able to pass a licensing exam, which they're tough. So it's a benchmark that I think is really crucial. So you have different varieties of again, you have people who like what are LMHCs, licensed mental health counselors. I think back in Chicago they had L. LCPC, Licensed Clinical Practical Counselor. You have licensed marriage and family therapists. You have licensed, I think it's LADC, like one or two licensed addiction specialists. And again, I'm just referencing from, you know, from Massachusetts and more so the United States. And then you have the doctoral level. Well, you have the PsyD and you have the PhD. One is a more research degree, one is more of a clinical degree. So that is a very different level of training from various clinicians. So, I mean, I've worked with, you know, just because I have a doctorate, I've worked with plenty of people who are master's level licensed clinical social workers or licensed mental health counselors who are amazing at therapy and the craft and what they do. But it really is important, I think, one, that your clinician is well trained. Two, that your clinician has enough experience in dealing with whatever issues you may be coming to. Because, you know, and this is why I'm so, you know, adamant about getting testing, because people don't come in and say, I'm coming in because I have a personality disorder. Now, I should say that's a little bit different because since I've started the podcast, I never thought that I would be getting patients as a result of that. That is not my reason for doing this at all. But I have a lot of people coming in saying, I think I have borderline. I think I have antisocial. I think I have histrionic. I think I have dependent. I think I have avoidant. I think I have schizoid. So I think I've changed, starting to change the landscape a little bit. But people generally come into therapy because something hurts. Their sadness, their anxiety, mood swings. They were hospitalized psychiatrically and they're discharged. So people come in usually at the cusp of when they're not at their best. And they come in because something hurts. And that is the advantage of doing neuropsych evals, is you are able to get to the nitty-gritty idiosyncrasies of what constitutes the psychological architecture and disposition of an individual. Now, from a therapy standpoint, and I think, you know, there's people who have that, you know, psychoanalysis is a very different form of therapy. I had a training in it, but I am not a psychoanalyst. That, you know, the short and long of that is resolving, you know, your current conflicts by going back into childhood, resolving past childhood traumas. And it's generally about 2 years. But it is something that is practiced. And for those of you who follow us, you know that I am very strict cognitive behavioral therapist. Julie is, I think, more of in a combination of CBT and dialectical behavioral therapy. But one of the most important things, if you're in therapy, is you have to be able to connect with your therapist. You have to be able to connect on a human level in order for anybody to tell their story. If someone's sitting there and they're taking notes, and I've heard this from a lot of people, is they don't make eye contact, they're just taking their notes, they're not really offering anything. And I tell people, if you're talking more than your therapist is talking, that's a problem. And this is, again, rational emotive cognitive behavioral therapy, which is very goal-directed, and it's kind of like, let's go, let's pick it up, let's get to the problem. But there has to be a level where you feel a sense of trust, you feel a sense that you're being heard, and you feel comfortable, because no one else is going to tell you. I mean, no one's going to tell their story or their innermost problems to somebody that they can't connect with, whether that's in a therapeutic relationship or a dating relationship or just any kind of relationship. Especially in psych, it's very different than going to your PCP where they're checking your blood pressure and all, you know, those kinds of blood sugar, that kind of stuff. This is getting into like the most personal aspects of someone's lifestyle. Could be their relational dynamics, their parenting skills, their relationship with their spouse, their sexual lifestyle. Very personal things that people get into, because psych, you know, psych is this very private thing, because it's more about who we are. So having that level of trust and confidence and feeling safe is very, very important. I have a very unconventional style about myself. I'm in jeans and leather jacket and rolled up sleeves, or Lululemon and motorcycle boots or leather jacket, and I do that because not because I'm trying to be somebody, because that's who I am. And I try to convey authenticity as just, yeah, I got tattoos and earrings, but, you know, I tell people, like, all these diplomas and stuff on my wall. I said, that just makes people think I know what I'm talking about. But I can't tell you how many people have walked into my office and asked for Dr. Nigro, and I say that's me, and then they're like, oh, because they're expecting, you know, your prototypical psychologist, doctor in a you know, sport coat, dark rimmed glasses, you know, dress pants, and that is just not me. And I found from my perspective that it really works because you relate to people, and I think it should be a safe space, and you should also feel that you're making progress. And you know, one person who emailed me, I'm gonna see if I can just find this. I'm not going to read the entire thing, but this is, I think, kind of, you know, encapsulates what I'm trying to get across, which was, you know, how to choose the right therapist. And what they're saying is, I have seen therapists in the past and never really found any that I completely, quote unquote, clicked with. One thing I would like to see is a therapist ongoing, as it seems these issues of mine crop up or have never been resolved. I have the feeling so many therapists operate in the model of see me twice a week at first, then once a week, and then every other week, and you are out the door in 10 and 12 weeks. I think that is commonplace in a lot of different, and it really depends on what is the issue. There are some things that are situationally based, maybe, you know, going through a loss or grief that can be short term. But therapy in and of itself is indeed a relationship, a professional relationship. You talk about self-disclosure. I think self-disclosure is important when it's relevant. But sometimes there's something called transference and countertransference. And transference is what a patient will project onto their therapist. Countertransference is what the therapist will project onto their patients. And it's very important to be mindful of that. If you are a patient, that you are not your therapist's therapist. And I have come across many cases that I've heard these stories from people that they're talking to them about their marriage or their sex life or their kids. And that's really not appropriate. But self-disclosure about, like, you know, I could talk about, you know, loss, because I'm someone who's young who lost both of his parents. So, I mean, I don't think that's inappropriate, but I think if you find yourself being the, you know, like I'm the therapist for the person I'm paying every week, that could be problematic. So, you know, and when you get in a testing, you know, there's schools can do some testing. I don't really like the school evals. I find them to be not effective, because neuropsych evals, maybe I'm pinch, you know, I have a penchant towards that, and it may have some bias because of the degree and the level of training that I went through to do testing. But, you know, neuropsychological evaluations, you're trained in all the testing of, you know, all the neuropsych stuff, the cognitive aspects, intelligence, adaptive behavior rating scales, neurological disorders, psychiatric conditions, neurocognitive conditions. That does require a doctoral degree, because when we purchase tests, you have to, you know, you have to have a certain, at least, in the United States, they're A, B, C level tests. And for the majority, the gold standard of neuropsych and psychiatric tests, in order to purchase them, you have to have the C level, which is the doctoral level licensure. But again, just because someone has a doctorate doesn't mean they're good. I mean, I think just because somebody is, you know, has their degree in a mechanic or, you know, has went to culinary school, and I think in any profession, it doesn't mean, you know, they're the best ones. But, you know, people, you know, is there burnout in this field? I said this before. I'm very grateful that as much as I work, and I work a lot, I never feel like I am working. You know, I tell people, you know, writing the neuropsych evals takes a while because I take a lot of pride because it's an individual's life, and it takes me. I write everything from scratch. I don't do cookie cutter evals. So I'm fortunate to be able, you know, just from training and years of doing this, I can pretty much figure out at the end of a session with somebody what their diagnostic picture is. So I can communicate with their clinician or refer them to a therapist that I'm connected with, or get them in for meds with Julie, or if it's a child, get them in with other colleagues and pretty much present them with their diagnostic picture prior to having to write the entire eval. But, you know, I think it's helpful. And if you're a clinician out there, having supervision, we're going to get back to doing what we call psych night with our colleagues who do therapy and meds, because I think in this field, a lot of what we hear can sometimes, and there's nothing that somebody could tell me that I have not heard. There's nothing somebody could tell me that would be like, oh my God, maybe I'd have that reaction of like, you did that when I've known you for a while. But I think a healthy level of desensitization. And I also think it's important that you work with a clinician who is familiar with the issues that you're dealing with. Not somebody who says, well, I don't really treat that, but I'll give it a try. You know, I took a class on that in graduate school, but you be my first patient, I'll try it. That the intentions might be good, but you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And with certain disorders, especially borderline, that's the one where you really need a significant degree of training and experience and knowledge across learning theory, attachment theory, behavioral psychology, psychopathology, general diagnostics, personality disposition, all that type of stuff is so crucial. So I brought this up one of the other episodes. If you look on Psychology Today, and there's probably different versions in different parts of the world, Psychology Today, if you look at my profile, I check off every single disorder. And that's because I primarily do diagnostics. Does that mean I specialize in the treatment of them? Absolutely not. Could I treat a vast majority of them? Absolutely. But like EMDR is something that is a very specific technique for trauma. I have amazing colleagues who do that. I do not do that. You know, so I don't specialize in, you know, treating, you know, specific disorders. So, you know, we're trained, at least at the doctoral level, we're trained to treat a vast, you know, the variety of all the different disorders within a general framework. But there are specialties like, you know, like severe anorexia, severe OCD, where there a lot of times those require very specific inpatient or intensive outpatient programs. You know, sometimes it's outside the scope of a medication provider where the level of care. And I think it's also important that, you know, that there isn't a superiority complex with your therapist. And, you know, I think one of the best, most liberating things for me and just growing up and growing up professionally is, you know, I don't, being able to say, I don't know, but I'll find the answer. And I do use books and I do use textbooks and I, you know, and I read textbooks, you know, if I, you know, for pleasure, but you know, I think being a perpetual student and not stagnating, because this is a field that is constantly changing, is constantly evolving. And I appreciate that a lot of you pick up on the passion in my voice. Julie and I, again, are very different from each other in terms of me being the extrovert, her being the introvert, but I can let, if Julie wants to pop on, well, she's walking past me, so she's, oh, I guess, no, you want to say anything? No, your audience? Well, Julie's waving hi. So, you know, it's also important that you know, you have the right to interview your therapist. You have the right to ask them what their education is, where they went to school, what their experience is with whatever issues you're presenting with, or your family, or your child, or your loved ones are presenting with. And I, when I, you know, even telling this to people, just, you know, not so much over the podcast all the time, but even in person, like, really, I can ask that? Yeah, absolutely. You have a right to know what your treatment goals are. You have a right to know, you know, what somebody's level of experience is. And yeah, may catch somebody off guard, but I have no problem. I've done it before. People say, well, you know, we want, can we meet you? Absolutely. You know, telehealth is a different entity in and of itself. And let me back up before getting into telehealth. You know, there's a whole other area of paraprofessionals that I think it's important to be mindful of when you're getting into life coaches. I don't know what a life coach is. There's no degree. There's no credentialing. There's no, I mean, anybody can call themselves a life coach. So I have a lot of people say, well, I work with this life coach or a mentor, you know, which is a good episode on Seinfeld of the mentor. But again, I don't know what a life coach is. And a life coach is not a licensed therapist, is not a licensed professional. You have people who are these coaches, whether it's executive functioning or behavioral coaches. These are not licensed professionals. And it's important that you if you're working with somebody or you're entrusting your loved one with somebody, that, you know, there's certain things that are protected in the United States, at least by law, that, you know, you practice, this is your scope. But then, you know, getting back to telehealth, that's a whole other version in and of itself, I think, which has really been a benefit for a vast majority of people, of opening up another gateway into the mental health system that they may otherwise not have entered. So sometimes, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, and, you know, the telehealth was here before the pandemic, but certainly not to the degree and the extent that it is right now. And I know there's people who love it. The people that have kids, I think, tend to struggle with it a little bit, especially if their issues are related to their parents and they don't have the privacy to really talk about it. And the people that I find do really well with it, and again, this is anecdotally from, you know, going through the pandemic and working with people and doing neuropsych evals remotely, for the grace of God, I was able to figure out how to do that. But you know, people who kind of had that established relationship, you know, I was seeing you in the office and we've known each other for a while, and now we're all on lockdown or in quarantine, and now we're just seeing heads over Zoom or DoxyMe or different, you know, platforms. Those people tended to do well because there was already an established relationship. But I think there's something, you know, where people really kind of fundamentally, as humans, you know, that remember I talked about the life task, the love task, the sex task, and the work task, that human connectedness of being across from somebody and sharing your innermost problems and secrets or desires, and having that and seeing that body language in that individual in person, I think can really lead to a significant, it really has a significant impact, and telehealth kind of takes that away a little bit. And I'm glad it's here because it has opened up many different avenues for people to get into mental health that may not have means for transportation, or may not have money for transportation, or may, you know, for or physical limitations may inhibit their ability to travel. So it is a great medium. And I think just the influx of mental health and again, talking to people worldwide, this is a universal problem. There's a huge shortage of people in the mental health system. And, you know, I used to be able to refer people. I could text my colleagues in real time while the patient's sitting across me after I did the neuropsych eval, sending you so-and-so, sending you so-and-so, sending you so-and-so. You text back, sure, I'll get them in next week. And now the wait lists are extraordinary. And this is, I think, it's kind of a catch-22. Do you wait for that person who is specializing in, you know, whatever disorder you may be struggling with, or a family member? Do you wait for that person, or do you just take whoever you can get because you need to talk to somebody? And I think that's an individual decision. And I'd rather see somebody with someone getting help. But also, I tell people, you know, have somewhere to be able to put yourself in a safe space, but also maybe get on the wait list and wait for when this person has an opening, because they have the skills that I would think would be more appropriate to treat whatever issue it is that they are dealing with. So again, it's a catch-22 at this point, but I don't see the mental health system improving in terms of availability. And it's great that so many people people have been inspired by the podcast to want to get into the field of psychology. But choosing the right therapist, I thought was a great topic because you don't know. You know, it's just like saying, hey, go see Johnny. He's a great mechanic. Or you got to go to this restaurant. We trust the opinions of people. But I think when it comes down to things that are so personal and so part of our infrastructure and about our lives and about the things that have meaning to us and the things that may have shame or may be embarrassing to admit, like sexual addictions or gambling problems, stuff that you know the outside world could easily look apart and say be judgmental, and you should never ever feel judged by your clinician. You can be challenged. That's more than appropriate, but you should never be judged and you should never be penalized for how you feel or how you think. You can be held accountable. And you could be questioned using kind of what we call like the Socratic dialogue. That's therapeutic and that's treatment. Judgment has no part in psychotherapy. And if, you know, again, as humans, we all have our own, you know, to say just suspend all judgment. I think I do a pretty good job of being judgment free. Doesn't mean I might not, you know, back my head kind of, you know, my eyes kind of like, oh, geez, really? But it shouldn't be made to feel that you are inferior, that you are less than because you have a psychiatric condition or that your family does. You know, back in the United States, back in the 50s and 60s, and this from working with older adults, trying to get a family history, they didn't talk about it. There was so much shame around mental health. There was, you hid crazy Uncle Harry in the closet. Or it wasn't. Grandpa was an alcoholic. He just worked at the factory all day and then went to the bar, you know, 7 days a week. So I think we've come a long way. And this was, one of the reasons for doing this podcast was to destigmatize mental health. But I think we have evolved. But we need a lot more voices out there encouraging people to take the shame. And I like the episode that Julie and I did. She did or I did, but you don't want to like shame off of you. There is no shame in mental health. Whatever condition you have, whatever condition that a family member may have, it is something that you have. It is not something that you are. Do not define yourself by it. Do not wear it like a coat or as your most comfortable blanket. Embrace yourself. Embrace your good qualities. Embrace your bad qualities. Embrace the things we need to work on. For the love of God, we all have things to work on. We all are perpetual students in a world that is incredibly chaotic, is in a state of constant turmoil, a world that we are so disconnected and just so judgmental and also hypersensitive. We have movements for everything. You can't say anything to anybody without somebody getting offended. So I think, the pendulum swings. And I think the pendulum needs to eventually get back to some equilibrium and the middle. But I really want to, encourage you to, just don't settle for whoever is sitting across from you. And I can tell you there are a lot of amazing, amazing people that I know and work with. I don't want to say their names unless they give me permission out of respect. But they are amazing therapists and prescribers, and I am privileged to work with them. And there's a lot of people out there that don't know what they're doing, just like in any other profession. And psychiatry and psychology are very, very significant and important fields that require a lot of training and knowledge and passion, because saying the wrong thing sometimes can be a life or death choice for an individual. A reaction or lack thereof can also be a life or death decision for an individual, or even bordering on self-harm. So depending on what you're dealing with. So again, it should be a safe space. Again, I would definitely encourage you, if you look for a therapist, that they are licensed. Weekly therapy is the most effective. As you progress through treatment, meet weekly can maybe go after several months to maybe every other week. Sometimes I've seen patients, depending on what they were going through, three times a week, because, there was medical necessity for that. But, it is a relationship, and you know, sometimes people just need maintenance therapy where they need to check in like once every 6 months or once a year to see how they're doing, because you know the goal of treatment is to treat it. You know, whether you stabilize it through medication and psychotherapy, or you eradicate it, like you can treat borderline personality and can eradicate that. Other thing like schizophrenia or bipolarity may require more ongoing treatment, but the goal is stabilization, remediation of symptoms, and getting people back to a level of a lifestyle where they say, you know what, I'm doing okay. I'm happy. We all have bumps in the road, but again, please, there's no shame in being in therapy. And if you guys have any questions, I'll give you my contact information. But I thought, you know, the person who reached out to me, and just I didn't get into the personal story of the narrative, out of respect for privacy. I thought it was a really relevant thing, because a lot of people have asked that in different ways, and I didn't address it because I, you know, I began working on being more prepared every week. But this was a topic that, you know, this one I'm doing off the top of my head, but it's a relevant topic. And again, just because somebody has letters before or after the name doesn't mean that they are the best for you. And you have an equal right in that relationship to ask questions and to talk about things and decide who it is you want to see.
Should talk about addiction counselors, because a lot of people.
Hi guys. I'm just gonna say something really quick. I find that when I work with people who have like a dual diagnostic presentation, like addiction with depression or bipolar or anxiety, PTSD, so on and so forth, I very often find that when people are in recovery or are recovered or still in recovery, but you know, successfully sober, maintaining sobriety, that people tend to find you know, substance abuse counselors to be really helpful. They tend to find their sponsors, if they are, you know, they belong to AA or other associations like that. They find the people who have walked the walk are the most helpful to them. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. I think there are coaches out there. I think there are people out there right now that aren't licensed that do a good job. I think that this is something to kind of consider depending on what you want and what you're looking for. It's kind of like trying on shoes. And sometimes it's a good fit. And then sometimes, you know, it's also important that if you're struggling in therapy, is to give your therapist the benefit of the doubt and talk to them about what you're struggling with. And this means I very often, you know, we have a great group that we work with. But I do have clients that see other therapists, you know, not in our group. And, you know, sometimes I'll just ask them, like, what are your treatment goals? And I know Cor talks about that a lot, that how important that is to have treatment goals. But it's also important to, you know, understand what is going on with you, and have the therapist really understand, have an understanding of what's going on with you. And a lot of that can be when it comes to, you know, psychiatry and psychology, it's having the education to know about the different things that could possibly be happening with a human being and being, you know, taught the skills. And then, you know, having internships and preceptorships and all sorts of things like work or jobs, you know, where we gain training and mentors who help us along the way to help us learn the skills, not just reading the skills and being tested on the skills, but actually applying the skills. And, you know, sometimes you're going to be working with people who are not licensed yet, but are on track to be licensed. And there's nothing wrong with that. I just want, you know, to put out there, you know, there are a couple people you know, that I follow on Instagram that I like very much, and that's Gabby Bernstein and Mel Robbins. But I don't know if either one of those two women are licensed technically, but yet they are really making a huge impact on the world. So I think there's influencers out there and people who may not be licensed, but they, if they're helping you reach your goals, that's okay too. So I wanted to just caveat that.
Different perspective than I have. I'm more of an advocate of going towards the route of somebody who's licensed and trained. I think people can be influencers and say influential things and motivational things, but, you know, against what Julia said, that's, influencers are providing treatment. And coming up with a good quote every now and then, that's great. It can be inspirational, but that's not treatment. But I do think we can learn from people who are influencers. I think we can take some of those quotes and incorporate them into therapy. Like Julie really turned me on to Sadhguru, and I reference him in Neuropsych Evals for people to follow. So it's important to not be as closed-minded. So hopefully this was helpful. Again, much appreciation to the audience that we have and that follow us and that continue to grow, and try to post more on Instagram and getting back to people. So never feel bad to reach out. If I haven't gotten back to you, just keep reaching out. I will do my best to get back to you whatever medium. So in the meantime, feel free to email me directly at psychologyunplugged@outlook.com. You can get a hold of me directly through Psychology Today. You can follow us on Instagram at psychology_unplugged_ on Instagram. And again, our true sincere appreciation for people who come from other parts of the world and the country. It's incredibly humbling and heartfelt gratitude. And have a happy, safe week, and I will talk to you guys next week. Bye, guys.